How many people liked your meal? Yeah, very good. Very, very good. And I really think during the day, I know you've been noticing Don. He's been running around doing everything we ask him to do and more. Yeah. Exactly. But thanks, Don. Really, thanks for the great service. It's been wonderful. Well, tonight, our banquet speaker is Jens Schoenfeld. And, you know, as I was looking at your website, Jens, I noticed it says, since 1994. Now, if that memory serves me correctly, and sometimes it doesn't, but wasn't that the year that Commodore went bankrupt? Yeah, so, okay. All right. Yeah, so you're looking at someone who has a tremendous amount of courage, and undeterred has brought out, I forgot to count them, a whole long list of products for Amiga expansion since 1994, all hardware, as far as I'm aware. Is that correct? Yeah, okay. I bought a couple of them. They work flawlessly. And I was thinking, you know, it takes a lot of guts, to start a company for an Amiga brand that's just died. You know, and you think, well, you know, it kind of goes against all the rules, and that's great. We love people who do that. So he's going to talk to us tonight about something that he has pre-formatted here. And so if you want to go ahead and get ready for that, I understand you're going to use the projector and all that good stuff. Of course. Of course. And so, go for it. We are... Now, the other question I wanted to pose to you while he's taking care of matters here is every year at this banquet, we talk about whether we're going to go ahead with another show next year. And so this year, it's no different from previous years, and we always ask everybody, you know, well, what do you think? Do you want to come back for another AMU West next year? This is year number 9 for us, 1998 to 2006. Is that right? I can't count anymore. So 8 years, 9 years, whatever it is, a long time. And our intention had always been, the organizer's intention had always been to provide an Amiga store for people in the Sacramento area after our two Amiga stores closed. I believe they closed in 97. Was that correct, Alan? I think it was 90. Yeah, I think there was. Yeah, because they had talked about bringing the store to Sacramento, and so that was the original intent. Thinking, of course, that someone would pick it up, and make great things out of the Amiga since then, and several people have tried, and there are people who are still trying and still doing good things. But we're still here, and our corporate sponsorship is, well, we don't have any corporate sponsorship. So what we want to know from you is, are you interested in another AMU West next year? Let's see your hands. Okay. All right. Well, it's actually on Chuck's shoulders here, because Chuck is the one who does most of the work. He's the one who arranges for this facility. He's the one who does just about everything under the sun when it comes to the hotel and things like that. Every year I think I mention this, but Chuck has had experience at doing conferences for up to 5,000 attendees. So this is kind of like, just kind of like falling off a log for him. So, which is good. We love it. arranges for this banquet. Does most of the on-the-ground stuff, and we just try to help him and stay out of the way. So I think we should give Chuck another big hand for this year's show. So AMU West 2007 will most likely be here, and hopefully we'll have some corporate sponsorship. hopefully we'll be able to show you some, not only show you some hardware this year, and I think Steve made a good point this morning. You know, progress this year was that we actually had a new hardware to see. We don't have it to buy yet, but we have it to see. And that was an improvement over last year. You know, last year we didn't. We just had rumors of new hardware. You know, we had nothing new hardware-wise. We had another update to the OS, but which we have again this year, an update 4 to OS 4. And so, you know, progress is being made, albeit in computer terms, very, very slowly. But, you know, we're not in a hurry. So we just really enjoy using these things. I know I we waited this long, exactly. There's no reason why we can't wait a little longer. So it's up there in the front. So we will be attempting to see what we can do for MUS next year right here in Sacramento. And I know, you know, I really have admired what Jens has done over the years with his company. And like the interview, how many of you read the interview that we included in your packet? Okay, good. It's good reading. And, you know, apparently the whole interview is in Total Amiga, issue 25, which is coming out. So, you know, we really are, I think, at least in my opinion, privileged to have Jens here with us all the way from Germany, and Oliver all the way from Germany. And we applaud your effort as well. Yeah, there it is. So I used to live in Germany, so I have some sort of grasp about how far away that is. takes a long time. I really enjoyed my time there. So without further ado, we will hand Jens the mic and the stand if you want it. I don't know if you want it. And hopefully we can unwrap this thing. There we go.
I have prepared something today. It's still a little bit technical, but last time I spoke at the banquet of Amy West, it was very technical. Some of you might have been here. I mean, I see very familiar, a lot of familiar faces. That was very technical. That was the I explained how we were planning to to read data off of disks. I used terms like flux transition and all that kind of stuff. A lot of hungry people were sitting there, understanding not very much of what I was talking about. And I thought I'll prepare something different this time, because there is something that that we encountered when we reverse engineered the Amiga chipset. A lot of people might think that there's a lot of magic to the Amiga, and I can confirm that. It's not only magic, it's so much more. The Amiga chipset is something that cannot possibly be made by humans. I will demonstrate this by it is impossible, and you will see that. Why is it not starting? You're right. First of all, we started looking at these chip numbers, and we're thinking there must be something to it. I mean, some of them are really close together, some are totally off. For example, the Gary chip. There must be something with these numbers, and we thought, okay, it must be a hint, because there is no obvious logic in there. So we started looking and tried to recombine these numbers, and we found something that gave a hint to the true makers of the Amiga chipset. We did some calculations. They might sound weird, but the results are stunning. The Amiga chipset, the numbers, they really contain a lot of. This doesn't work without mathematics. It doesn't work without formulas. But it is. As you can see, if you have a pocket calculator or something with you, you can prove it. I mean, numbers do not lie. Numbers don't lie. If you put it into this formula, you really get the mass of an electron out of the Amiga chipset. And this is something that was really stunning. I mean, what kind of engineer would put this kind of knowledge into the chip numbers? I mean, isn't this the not just a hint, isn't this the proof that this this chipset must contain alien technology? Amigans, do you believe? Great. But that's not all. That's not all. We found more. The mass of a proton is also inside of the Amiga chipset. And again, try it in your pocket calculators. You're going to see that these numbers match exactly the numbers of the constants that you can find in any physics book. So this is the proof that the true makers of the Amiga chipset have had a deep understanding of what the world is really about, what holds the world together. They have an understanding of the meaning of life. They had it all. And this is not all. We even found the acceleration due to gravity. The number that is being used to calculate the force that that the of gravity, something you how do I explain this? Pardon? Yeah, when you drop an Amiga. Yeah. I mean, physicists, engineers, researchers worldwide, they have been looking for an explanation of gravity, but it's here. The chip numbers are giving the exact numbers. This is the proof, isn't it? Amigans, do you believe? This is... Pardon? Okay, and it even works the other way around. Some of you might have thought, well, how do these hardware designers choose the next chip to work with? And I'm revealing a secret here. We are choosing the chip numbers by the way what we want to achieve. Let's take the those constants that we just calculated, the mass of an electron, the mass of a proton, and the acceleration due to gravity. Now we want to have something really power saving. So we need the constant E, which is the smallest electrical load that you can find, the electrical load of a single electron. And we want to have something really fast, lightning fast. Therefore, we introduce the speed of light into the formula. And let's say I want to make a real fast accelerator, something really stunning fast. Here is the formula that I'm using. And if you have, like I said, if you have a pocket calculator, punch in the numbers, and this is what comes out. Do you know what this is? This is the Coldfire V4. It's all there. Now, this is the proof that we got to have something. This alien technology is telling us not only to have the Amiga chipset, but also to use the ColdFire processor, the direct successor to the classic Amiga CPU. So yeah, but there is one guy out there who has been working on a ColdFire CPU card for the Amiga for like 5 or 6 years or something. His product is called ColdFusion. And I have to tell you, ColdFusion is a secret code. This guy wants to tell us something. If you rearrange the letters of ColdFusion, cold in UFOs, he couldn't possibly say something about the temperature of a UFO unless he has been there. So he's definitely using alien technology. I mean, how else would you expect somebody to ignore the fact that the processor will never be able to execute unpatched 68K code? He's using alien technology. That's why we all cannot explain it. That's it. And I can see you all guys have some humor. I mean... we've seen something really hilarious earlier today. That was the Troika, the Prometheus board, there is a secret code in Prometheus as well. If you rearrange those letters, you find out what the true meaning or what the makers of the Prometheus board get their fun out of. They just want to see drunken animals. So, like I said, there is a lot to hardware design. It is not just putting chips together and learning on how to arrange the signals in the right way. You just have to know the codes, the secret codes, and it's here. Do you believe? Okay, so what's this shit all about? This playing with numbers, it works with almost any set of five numbers. So you can if you can arrange almost any set of five numbers to match the numbers that you need. There is one scientist from the Netherlands. His name is Cornelius de Jager. He has invented a new kind of religion because he thought, well, there are 16 million citizens of the Netherlands, but there are 20 million bicycles, so there must be something special to the bicycle, huh? So he took some measurements of the bicycle, such as the diameter of the lamp and the diameter of the wheels and the length of the pedals and everything, and he calculated all these physical constants, even more, not just the mass of protons and everything, and by that he proved that the a Dutch bicycle was made by aliens, just like I did with the Amiga. The precision of these calculations is stunning. You can have easily 3-4 digits after the comma. That's more precise than the constants that you find in any school book. Needless to say, any of you who has been doing calculations in his physics class, you always have to calculate also with the units. If you are trying to find out what unit comes out of those formulas that I just presented here, it's just BS. And of course, I could have given you any kind of interpretation. I mean, if there is somebody presenting a lot of numbers and you just believe it because the calculation is correct, then you probably believe any kind of interpretation that I'm serving here. So, great, yeah. So what I want to say is only believe what you can see. I mean, for example, a board that works, and not just something that is shown for pictures or whatever. I mean, there are multiple other reasons to not believe that this Troika Prometheus board will ever work, but I guess it's enough that not only one hardware designer, but also other hardware literate people have issued on the net that there are some problems to the Troika board that will probably never make it work. I have no idea why they did that, but let's see. Same with the Cold Fire. I don't know what the reason is to really advertise something, and then to tell these people, well, you are going to be preferred if you buy our current product now. Then later on, you're going to be preferred if we deliver the accelerator. Totally ignoring the fact that the Cold Fire is not going to execute any 68K code unless it's completely either modified or completely emulating the 68K. I wrote it on the net in discussion forums a number of times. Nobody's believing me, but I predicted that this Cold Fusion is not going to come out until April 2004 or so, or was it April 2005? Well, that date has passed now, and I extend that to it's not going to come out while the Cold Fire is in production. So, I want to end this. Thanks for your time. And you've been a great audience. I also want to take the chance to thank Chuck Washburn to organize this show, and of course for inviting us. As always, I'm having a great time in the U.S. with the Amiga people of the United States here, and I hope to be back next year.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've never heard mathematical ultimate truth addressed in that fashion. You can do just about anything with numbers. That was a lot of fun. Thanks. Now we have... As requested, Bill and Carl were starting to ask and answer questions, and so we're going to continue that sort of fireside chat format here. And I don't know what would make it most comfortable for the both of you. Beer, oh boy. whatever you guys... Okay, so... I guess the rest of us will just go down in the audience and listen to the rest of this. I'm looking forward to this myself. Yeah. Yeah, sorry we can't provide the real relaxation stuff.
I find it interesting that, and maybe an alien coincidence of some kind, that there was a point when we were getting emails to Rebel saying that Rebel was obviously alien technology because there wasn't anything like it around, and where could this have mysteriously come from? But all of that email came from Germany. So I wonder what's going on over there. The truth comes out.
We moved Roswell.
Roswell, yes. Roswell is a new place in Germany.
So I think before we broke for the banquet, we were talking about Rebel. Okay. I think everyone would like to be entertained a little bit while we're sitting here digesting. Give us a story. Give us one of the old days. Crazy nights, maybe something we don't know.
Oh.
you know, what is it? What is it now? It's we're talking 90, talking 83, 84, right? So we're over 20 years ago. What's the limitations on secrets? It's got to fall in that. So you got to be able to lose.
Well, there's so many stories, you know. There are so many stories, and I don't know which ones you've heard, you know. So that's always the difficult. You know, I invited RJ and Dale Luck and Dave Needle, who is the one that really was the sidekick of Jay Miner, who really did a lot of work on the chips with Jay, Agnes Chip and things like that. He was actually at RJ's this week, and I said, while he's there, invite him up too. And there were actually two other people from the original Amiga computer that, you know, that were at his house this week. So it's like, why don't you come on up? We'll have a little mini reunion. And unfortunately, they're not here. And shame on you, RJ. Where's the network camera? There it is. Shame on you for not making it. But I suggested to Chuck and Brian that you know, we could do like a fireside chat thing. And this is actually something, a different conference I go to this time of year is called the Hackers Conference. And it's really quite fun because there is this, you know, this one day where someone of some distinction, you know, comes up and tells a story about about how he created email, you know, 60 years ago or 50 years ago or whatever. So, yeah, well, let's see, stories. You know about RJ's fish in the microwave oven, right? I mean, you know about this one? Okay, So we used to work long hours, and RJ one evening decided he'd bring a fish in that he had cooked at home, and he put it in the microwave oven, and somehow he had slipped on the digits, and he put it in for like a half hour or something in the microwave oven, and this fish just exploded all over the place, and you can imagine what that smells like. So the next day, you have people, you know, coming to visit Amiga. And that was a very small building. I mean, the whole building of the original Amiga computer was like this, you know, the area of this room right here. You know, it was divided up, but that was about the size of it. And it was just unbelievable, you know. And for weeks and weeks, you know, people would come visit. You know, like Steve Jobs would stop by, you know, or whatever. And it's like, whoa, this smells very fishy, this whole thing. Of course, we were swiping the manuals out of, I don't know if I should say this thing. We were swiping the documents, I don't know how we were doing this, from Apple while they were making the Macintosh, okay? And somehow we were getting these manuals as they're, you know, in their draft forms, the developer manuals and everything describing their system. You know, we're filtering in through some magic alien transport or something and appearing on our desks. And, yeah, so... yeah, and Steve actually did visit. I don't know if you know that. Steve Jobs actually came by, you know, there's a lot of us who I mean, one of the things we know about Steve is that he's colorblind. I don't know if he actually is, but you know what? It sure appears that he's colorblind because he came in and he saw the Amiga, and we actually cleared everyone out of the lab except for just a couple of us, and gave him some demos on the Amiga, and they were really very, very impressive. You know, back in those days, and showed him all this color, you know, and animation. We had some terrific animations with synchronized sound and all that we did for demos, just for convincing people that this was a good project. And Steve looked at it and says, "Yeah, it's good hardware, but there's no software for it." And that was his reason. We were trying to convince him to, you know, to do a partnership or whatever with us to somehow unite and kind of conquer the world together. And of course, history shows that he then went off to the and started Next, and it was black and white. And actually, one of the first things I did when I got to Apple, after Amiga, I went to Apple. Okay, and one of the first things I did was push really hard for a color Macintosh. You know, I worked in the advanced technology group, and sure enough, that's where they developed this. They ended up developing the color Mac, and then they moved it over into the production division. It was actually forced on the company to do color. So it's a weird thing, you know, how some, you know, some folks don't think that's important, you know, color. So, yeah, another interesting story.
Well, I mean, that was always the challenge with the Amiga. From what I understand is that the Commodore folks, after they got their hands on it, didn't know what to do with it. The guys who were selling the products and to corporations and everything else looked at it and said, who needs graphics? Who needs color and this kind of thing for a business computer, right? And Now you look at PCs and we're, you know, many years later, with hindsight, but that's what they're all about now. It's all about making sure the buttons are rounded and that they're not, you know, that they've got gradients behind them and that they're pleasing to look at. I mean, it's a shock to put a lot of users who aren't familiar with it in front of a green screen. Here's your machine. Yeah, you hold the control and F2 and press B if you want to bold. It's amazing how far things have come, and people not knowing what they needed to do, what they needed, and not understanding that.
Yeah, well, that's true of a lot of things too. I mean, the multitasking was a really interesting one because the multitasking came about prior to going to Amiga. I worked at Hewlett Packard in the operating system group, and it was a real special kind of prestigious group at Hewlett Packard that was in charge of the operating systems for, you know, design of the next generation operating system for Hewlett Packard for their bigger machines, and while I was there, I started thinking about, well, I should back up a little bit and say that those were very large. I mean, you know, the racks of source code were as big as this table and this high, you know, of printouts for the source code for that operating, you know, for like the HP's primary operating system, MPE, the multi-processing executive. And, I started looking around, and I was seeing a lot of sort of research papers and little books and things written about operating systems, and you're saying, oh, you know, smaller is better kind of, you know, thing. And so I started designing while I was actually at HP. I started designing kind of my dream operating system. And the nice thing about working there at HP is you could, back in those days, it was very engineering friendly. And you could just order kind of anything you needed for anything that you were kind of curious about. One of the reasons I went to work for Hewlett Packard is during the interview, they take you in and, you go through the interview process, which was really intense, but they take you by what they used to call lab stock, okay, it was a room like, you know, half the size of that over there, which was just raw parts. Every single, you know, TTL, you know, package and every single little coil and inductor and capacitor and resistor and everything you possibly imagine, every little connector, it was all in those bins. And what they say to you is, that's your stuff. Think of that as your stuff. You can do whatever you want with that. If you want to build yourself a computer or, you know, make yourself a microwave ray gun or whatever you want to do, you know, that's it. You know, have at it. And just do it for fun. And that was really the HP attitude. And the other thing was, you know, if you need any books or any kind of, you know, need research papers from like Xerox PARC or whatever, which was just getting started in that time, and go ahead, order it, and we'll get it for you. And so I was collecting all that, and I had this huge pile of books, every book written about operating systems, and I read them all, and I concluded that we really could make this really lightweight operating system concept, and we were at the beginning of a new stage of developing operating systems, and so I proposed it at a conference like this, you know, and there were like all these engineers, and Philip is bigger than this, and it was just basically to decide what to do for the next operating system. I got up there and I proposed my idea. And I'll never forget, it's like the one guy, it was like the senior technical guy, he just was like, oh, ho, that's kind of a joke, you know. And the interesting irony is actually when I was at Apple, he came to interview for a job there in my in my department. it's interesting how that goes around. But the thing was that concept was building within me as to how to do this operating system. And so when the chance came, when I got the call, it was actually a buddy of mine who also worked at Hewlett Packard that went in to do the interview through, it was a headhunter that got a hold of him and brought him into Amiga to do the interview. And it didn't work out for some reason or another with him. But he called me up and he said, you know, Carl, this would be exactly the kind of thing that you'd like doing. Because they don't have any idea for what they want to do for an operating system. You know, they're talking Apple II here. And if you know the Apple II operating system, you know, it wasn't much of an operating system, really. It was very crude. And that was kind of where they had started. Jay and Dave Morris were sort of like, well, we want to do something like the Apple II, you know. And So I had another interview with another company. It was a little tiny company. It was two guys, and the company was called Symantec. Okay. And these guys were professors from Stanford, and they had this natural language translating program that went into a database, and so you could essentially query your database in natural language. And they had implemented it on a big VAX computer, and it was quite a large program, and what they wanted to hire me to do was to port this, and this was their whole business plan, was to port this VAX program that, you know, was only ran on that, you know, on that machine onto a PC. Okay, now PC at that point only had 64K of memory maximum.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're like, we're going to sell this on the PC, and it's going to, you know. And I just looked at it and I said, that, you know, and they wrote it in Lisp. It was all written in Lisp, too. And so they wanted it, as well as, you know, move, they wanted to translate it into C. And so I thought, these guys are obviously insane. You know? So I swapped with my friend. I said, you go down to Symantec. It's right up your alley. I knew he liked Lisp, you know. And I'll go over this little, you know, Amiga thing. Well, when Bob Parisot was the head of software at Amiga, and if you look on the back of your books that you bought today, you'll see a picture of a guy with a ponytail, okay? And that's Bob. And Bob was an incredible guy. He doesn't get much credit in the historical, you know, archives, because he really wasn't an engineer. He was the kind of project manager. And what I really liked about Bob was the fact that he was very hands-off. I mean, he hired us, you know, Dale and myself and RJ, and then he just backed away and said, you know, your goal is that, and, you know, I can see you're motivated, go do it. And what he said to me, you know, when I first met him, it's like, we need an operating system, right? Whatever operating system you want. I thought, I know exactly what I want. It's going to be a lightweight, you know, multitasking kernel. And it's like, multitasking, huh? Yeah, multitasking, okay. And you know, the funny thing is, I almost didn't go to Amiga because he called the house prior to my interview. He called the house, and I guess he was, like, really gruff with my wife, you know, on the phone. He didn't get a hold of me at that time. I was at work or something, and talked to my wife, and my wife said to me, oh, this guy from this company Amiga called, and he was a real jerk, and I don't want you to call him back. I don't think you should go work there. I was like, are you sure? You know, yeah, well, my friend said that actually it was okay. No, don't call him back. He's a real jerk. And she tried to really convince me not to go work for this little company. And I said, well, let me just drive down. And, you know, I called him back. He says, come on down. It's like, you know, 5 o'clock in the evening. And I drove on down. And actually, there was this really terrific whiteboard that I think has actually been preserved in history by Dale and RJ. It might be at Dale's house. It was a whiteboard that showed the block diagram of the Amiga. Okay, and you know, one of the other things I was really into, besides just, you know, multitasking, was multiprocessing. In other words, you know, before I got into computers, I did neurophysiology at research at University of California. Okay, and so I had studied the brain, and I knew that there was great power in parallelism of computation. And so one of my goals had always been to try to do that in computing a lot more, do a lot more. And so I was always studying parallel processors and how they, you know, how do you do that? And it's a very tricky thing. So I saw this diagram, this whiteboard. It was one of the first things he showed me. And it's like, wow, so you have the 68,000 processor here. It's isolated from this other thing over here, the coprocessor, and they can run in parallel. Whoa, this is very cool. You know? And, you know, at that point, and then you know, the diagram also has, like, all the DMA channels. And I don't know if you have this memorized, but there's 25 DMA channels. DMA is direct memory access channels, and those are channels that are being sliced in between the cycles of the processor, you know, doing its thing. These are being are sliced in on the bus to do things like get the graphics up on the screen and to run the sprites and to run the sound and run the floppy disk and all that stuff. And so once I saw that, I thought, these guys know what they're doing. This is an amazing, you know, personal computer. I've got to come work here. And they hired me that same day.
Wow.
Yeah. And oh, but my point of the story was, so for, you know, for the 2 years in which I was working there implementing, you know, the multitasking operating system, and you know, people would always say, well, what do you do in your job? You know, you go off somewhere else, you know, everyone at Amiga knew what I was doing, but outside, oh, I'm writing multitasking operating system. And they say, multitasking? What is that? Why would you want that? Yeah. Why would you want your computer to do more than one thing? And they were very serious about it. Nowadays the word multitasking is a word in English. I mean, you see it on television all the time. Oh, I'm multitasking. I'm on my phone and I'm driving. You know, and drinking a soda at the same time. You know. So I'm multitasking, and I say to my wife constantly, it's like, you know, I've been born in my own personal hell here. Because 20 years ago, no one knew what I was talking about. I said multitasking. Anyway.
And now everyone's doing it.
Now everyone's doing it.
They don't even know
why. Yeah, they don't know why that word, that aliens, you know, infuse that in our brain somehow, right?
Well, it's funny for me because I've studied a little bit about the past, and I kind of grew up a little bit after those days, but I knew of Apples and Amigas and so forth. And I see the ads that Intel's running now for the dual core, whatever they call them, because you really need two processors inside the chip in order to multitask on a Windows system. And I just find that just kind of revolting in some way, they're using hardware to try to get to what they could have gotten in software if they weren't as lazy or if they were a little smarter.
Yeah, that's the other part of my own personal hell is Microsoft.
So I wanted to ask, and you actually were getting into this, and I don't know the answer to this question, so I'm really curious. You're telling us that before you got there, you had this idea, you had this passion, this desire to do this, and when you got there, and there's been a lot of debate online and amongst folks for the last 20 years, is the Amiga a good software platform or is it a good hardware platform? And I think the answer is it's both. It's the synergy between the software and the hardware.
Yeah.
When you were thinking about the operating system, and in my limited experience, it seems like a lot of operating systems today are written for kind of a hardware architecture. How ingrained was the hardware before you got there, and how much did you have to either compromise or was it like a benefit that these things existed that you had to deal with, or did you push them in that direction?
That's an excellent question. I mean, that was really good. That's you know, when you're an engineer, you develop philosophies on certain things that are, I mean, they're like your core sort of engineering values. And one of my core engineering values is that software and hardware need to be done at the same time together because one influences the other. And that was something I found I should actually mention there's one other one that was really important to Amiga, which was the concept of VLSI, very large scale integration type chips. That was just getting there. I mean, doing custom chips at the time when Amiga was doing them was very expensive. It was, you know, there weren't a lot of processes around. It was a difficult thing to do. And when I heard this guy Jay Miner, you know, thought, I'm going to put this into a custom chip, I thought, this guy knows what he's doing. But to answer your question, both happened at the same time, and it was a wonderful thing. We were constantly going into the hardware guys, and you know, like Dale would find something in the, you know, in the Agnes chip, you know, he'd find, you know, like he could take the, you know, if he did the registers the right way, he could draw lines, you know, or he could do this or that, or you know, and like the screen pull down thing was a huge, you know, sort of like accident that came up. We were actually offsite at, I think it was at RJ's apartment or whatever, like, well, how do we deal with the fact that we've got different resolutions and they're going to be different frequencies? And someone was like, I think it was actually Sam Dicker who said, well, why don't we use the copper to reprogram the chips on the fly as we're going down the screen? And it's like, whoa, where'd that come from? Good thinking there, Sam. And Sam did the audio, you know, he was the audio guy from the software side. But so what happened is those kinds of ideas, we'd often have to go in and kind of get on our knees and beg the hardware guys because, you know, they were on schedule too. And they were like, you know, oh, you know, and it's like, oh, we can't do this, you know. You know, I'd kind of like push Dale in there. You got to go talk to him, Dale. Go talk to him. Get that thing done. Get that amazing thing done. Or I'd grab like Glenn Keller, you know, who did the Paula chip. Which I think was originally called Porsche, right? Maybe not me. That should be a good trivia question. The Paula chip is the interrupt controller for the Amiga as well. And I was writing the exec, and I needed to get every single little cycle of performance I could because I knew that most of the people who were going to program the machine were game programmers. And the worst thing for me is if their game starts and essentially boots out the operating, and kicks the operating system out of memory and just takes over. Okay, and I didn't want that to happen, so I needed to prove that the multitasking operating system could be fast enough to be able to run these games, you know, within the context of the operating system. Otherwise, it'd be the same thing as an Apple II. It would just sort of take over everything. And so I needed to be able to disable interrupts very, very quickly. And that's a difficult thing to do on the 68000 when you're in user mode because, you know, the processor has two modes, user mode, supervisor mode, and you cannot touch those registers from user mode. And so you have to throw an exception. The processor has to handle the exception. It goes into moving its stack and doing all these other things. There's a lot of microseconds that are lost on that kind of thing. And so I said to Glenn, hey, give me just one bit on Paula that allows me to disable all of the interrupts. And then I can write this little tiny macro function that in just like two lines of, you know, two instructions will disable that, and I can essentially prevent, you know, what you're trying to do is you're trying to lock out, it's called mutual exclusion. Mutex is also called for those of your programmers. But essentially prevent something else from interrupting something I'm already in. There was this critical section of code. You cannot be interrupted in it. There's just no way you want to interrupt, but you want to get in and out, and it needs to be as fast as possible. So I think I got him some popcorn or something, or I've sort of bribed him, and I took him aside in the kitchen. I said, I've got to have this. You've got to get me this somehow. You've got to make this one bit. And he did. He said, yeah, I'll do that. And you know, it's not too late. We can sort of sneak that in, you know, and we'll pretend like it wasn't there or something.
And that's one of the amazing things about the computer, that you can do that from the operating system, and when you need to, you can kind of get it out. I remember hearing a story about, and maybe you can elaborate on this, the NTSC output on the Amiga. And one of the reasons why the Video Toaster was so successful is the quality of the NTSC output was so phenomenal.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with
that? Yep, absolutely. I was one of the main people pushing that. What had happened was Motorola came out with a new chip. And, one of my other previous lives was I was in television. So when I was...
How old were you when you started?
Well, I'm now 450 years old.
Okay, so you've had some time in the industry. Yeah. That's good.
I did a lot of TV stuff before, you know, long before Amiga, and actually before I went to the university. The quality of the video was very important to me. And I read in Electrical Engineering Times or something about this new chip from Motorola that did this, you know, terrific, you know, encoding of NTSC, and that it was just like almost near perfect. And Jay, he was planning to put the same circuitry that he put into the Ataris, which was a very simple hack with a few resistors and kind of like a transistor or something that get, you know, that do the mix or whatever, and then you get this kind of fake aliased color. And
in that time and day, the television quality wasn't all that great either.
It wasn't. But we bought actually really nice Sony production quality monitors. So we bought basically top of line Sony monitors so we could look at the signal, and there was a little light on those monitors. I know some of you have seen those of you in the video. There's some video people in the room. You've seen those square Sony monitors. There's a little light on there, and that light will go on when you're locked to NTSC. And we looked up the spec. Actually, Dave Needle looked up the spec on that monitor to see what you had to be, and you had to be within plus or minus 3 hertz. Okay, not 3 kilohertz, 3 hertz. Okay, something along those lines. And it had to do with, you needed that precision for the color burst or something, you know, to get to ends. So that became, you know, Dave Needle's like mission in life. You know, it was to make sure he'd get that light to come on. So what ended up happening is that part was pretty expensive for Motorola. It was a new part. It was like, I think they'd gotten it down to like 75 cents or 50 cents or something like that. But then we were always multiplying things out times 10 million units, and it's like, wow, that's a lot of money. Will people appreciate it or not? Yeah. You know, will they really appreciate it? Will they be able to tell the difference?
Especially on the television sets that were available at the time.
And that's one of the few things where I really got down on my knees and begged Jay. I kind of hounded Jay constantly on that. Jay, please, please, please put in, so I can make my own videotapes and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And he finally did it. And boy, we were sure happy. I was sort of sad to see it get dropped out of the 500. I think it was the 500 that dropped it. And went back to, I guess, it went to monochrome, right?
Monochrome, yeah.
Yeah, monochrome on the 500 output, yeah. On the video output. Yeah, so disappointed they dropped that chip. But, you know, they're trying to cut costs, so, yeah.
Wow. Well, I think the Amiga, one of its greatest legacies and something that allowed it to reach to a much wider market, especially in the U.S., has been its video capability.
Yeah.
And I remember having a conversation in Toronto, and there's a real difference between the people who use the Amiga for computing stuff, for games, for word processing, Fauna Writer, and the rest, and the individual who used it for the video work. They spoke a different vocabulary, a different set of software, and all. I mean, it was very, very different in between the two. And I think it's a testament that you can have a single kind of product that can live in these different arenas.
Yeah, although it is true that I mean, the Amiga was good at so many things that it had a hard time finding a niche.
And that's
I think there's you know, many different areas of blame in that, but. It definitely did find the niche in the kind of video and the Hollywood stuff. One of my favorite stories on that is I was flying out of Burbank, and I had just sort of made the flight and just had gotten the ticket and just got on the airplane right as they're closing up, and I had the very last seat in the airplane. And it was way back in the corner. I had to kind of excuse myself, get by three people, and go sit in a seat. And I noticed the guys next to me were talking about, you know, making films and stuff and movies and whatever, and the guy said, "Yeah, I'll be up in Napa at Coppola's house for the next, you know, 4 weeks, and blah blah blah." And I thought, well, that's cool. He's going up to, you know, Coppola's, you know, and then he pulls out. But he said, "I brought a lot of reading though while I'm there," and he pulled out a stack of Amiga magazines, and he put them in the seat right in front of him, like there were like six Amiga World magazines or something, and I was like, "Oh, you have an Amiga?" "Oh, yeah, I have an Amiga. It's an amazing computer." I said, "Yeah, I know something about the Amiga." And it turns out he was a sound editor. He was heading up to edit the sound on the Dracula movie that Coppola made. And the real cool part was it was about, I don't know, maybe a year later that I walked in the house from whatever I was doing. And there he was on TV accepting his Academy Award for the sound on that movie. It was really cool. He did a newsletter that was like the newsletter for the people who are audio editors in Hollywood. And he used, you know, his Amiga for doing all the newsletters and all that kind of stuff. And that whole group was just, they were just locked into Amigas. They loved them, you know. And so it was really great, and that's why you see so many movies. And if you look at rent old movies, you see so many movies where there's like an Amiga, you know, 500 or Amiga 1000 in them or whatever.
Absolutely, in the background.
In the background, I saw a space one once where there's like the woman who was in charge of the spaceship is running the spaceship. Her console was an Amiga 500. She'd carry it around with her on the spaceship. You know what movie I'm talking about? I don't even know the name of it. I don't know. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I don't know, but yeah, this is really fun.
Isn't there a website where they track, like, Amiga sightings, something or other? There's a website out there that actually you can post, like, "I saw an Amiga on the desk in the principal's office in this movie," and stuff like that. It's amazing.
Well, again, that was the Genlock that made that possible, because you could lock the Amiga to the camera, you know, most computers couldn't do that, you know, it was a great thing about it.
So. Actually, I heard a story, or maybe read a story, about people over at ILM who actually built special video cards to put into PCs so that they can ensure they get the sync rate to lock to the camera.
Yeah.
So, as opposed to just, you know, selecting.
You had to do that for any shot on whether it's film camera or TV. You have to do that. Yeah.
Custom video cards for PCs for movies. Yeah. You wouldn't think about it.
Or just an Amiga, out of the box.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. So, we were talking earlier after, and you had mentioned about where you see Rebel going in the future, and you mentioned web terminology. And I thought it would be interesting to kind of get your take on the web phenomena. I guess we're a little past that because it's been 12 years, but it really kind of is if you look at the... If you look at the time scale of everything, I mean, it just accelerates. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Mobilization. I mean, jets started at the end of World War II 50 years ago, and it's phenomenal the way technology is increasing. But where do you see kind of the web, and where do you see that technology path leading? Do you think that it's going to be something like the Amiga that's going to be involved in that, whether it is or not? But where do you see that kind of, where do you see the progression?
He's a really good interviewer, isn't he?
You do this professionally?
No.
Oh,
I just have 8 years of experience doing it at Emmy West.
I'm ready to download his podcasts, you know?
Actually, I was hoping that Bill was going to be here, because Bill McEwen showed up. Was it 97 or 98? It must have been 98. It was in this room. The room was completely different. There was a stage over on that side, and I put his butt in front of a computer and got him on an IRC channel. And it's just amazing how far our technology has been able to progress in that realm as well. But
it's a really good question, and I mean, it's a very, very good question. And last year, Microsoft sent a film crew to my house to ask me that same question.
Well, I'm late.
They did. I showed up with like high definition camera and lights and everything. They set them up. It's like, we want to know, what do you see in the future?
What do they do with that?
I'm not telling.
I was going to say. Did you tell them about multitasking operating systems?
Yeah, multitasking is the way to go.
4,096 yeah. color graphics.
That's it. There's the future right there.
Let me show you the secret project.
It's funny because the guy that was the producer of it, I was showing him what I was doing in Rebel. It's like, wow, that is so much better than what we have at Microsoft. They force us to use it. We don't want to do it. Oh, he's probably fired now. Anyway, so the question's a really good one, and I like that question a lot, because it's the flow. You know, the web is so important. It's just phenomenal in terms of what it's become. And the web started out, as you all know, it was this little thing that was kind of done in a lab over in Europe, and the guy wanted to be able to publish his papers and came up with the form, you know, this method of doing it, and that was called Web 1.0. And Web 1.0 is really, it was really kind of a document page format. It wasn't meant to be interactive. He sort of wanted it. He kind of imagined that maybe it could become interactive. I'm talking about Tim Berners-Lee. And that it could become interactive, and that was really his dream, for it to be a two-way thing, not just a one-way thing. And so, but the web got kind of pushed in many different directions, and you know, advertisers got a hold of it, and you know, retailers got a hold of it, and really made it, you know, really pushed this little page formatting thing into a pretty big deal. And they did it without without doing a lot of, you know, good standards coordination between the different entities making web browsers, etc. And then, more recently, Web 2.0 ideas have come along. And if you read the discussion on Web 2.0, it's really kind of interesting, because they just kind of coined the term. They weren't sure what they were talking about at first. And it came out of O'Reilly, who does, you know, the Riley Press over on the coast over here. And you know, him and a few other guys were like, yeah, what is this we're seeing? We're seeing these more interactive applications that are running on the web. What is that? Well, we'll call it Web 2.0. And it was like the Web 2.0 came first, and then they were running around trying to find a definition for it. And the definition is still really, really fuzzy, but I kind of sifted down to it's an interactive web. And, you know, where your applications aren't just, you know, pages that are going back to the server every time they need to refresh. More is happening locally, because after all, your local computer is often more powerful than the server in the first place, especially when you consider the server is multiplexed with, you know, hundreds of users using it. So that's Web 2.0, and what I call Rebel is Web 3.0, okay, because Web 3.0 is really Web 2.0 done right, okay? Pretty obvious to me. I won't get into the technical stuff unless you're really interested in why I say that, but that's how we look at it. It's really the beauty of Rebel is that it runs on the server, it runs on the client, it's the same thing on both. And the data that's going back and forth is also Rebel. Okay, in other words, you don't need to encode it into XML with all the gobbledygook that XML has. Okay, and all the inefficiency that XML has, and the code. So the data going back and forth is in Rebel, and even what you're storing on disk, how you're storing it, the formats, what they call micro formats nowadays, which have become a kind of a hot thing in the software arena. The micro formats are in Rebel too. So it's really a, kind of a holistic approach to the problem.
But the system you're describing is like it's operating system agnostic. And if I look back at the development, we didn't have hardware. Well, we had hardware, but it was much harder than it was then when you first started, and the different kind of designs. And it like Microsoft started to provide development tools. That's where they saw the market going. They kind of stumbled into the operating system arena and then to Office, which is a device to print money.
Yeah.
And they're happy about that.
Yeah.
But looking forward, the OS and the hardware it runs on, the interconnect between these things, the size of the screen, the type of input. You didn't mention any of that in what you described. That's not an issue at all. It's much more ubiquitous at the technology layer, much more of the software side.
Right.
Is that
accurate? Yeah, that's right. The I sort of see. I mean, there's an ultimate resolution somewhere for your screen, and who knows how much higher it will go. There's an ultimate sound quality that, you know, it's the maximum the ear can hear plus surround sound and everything else. And so it's like the path of maturity in some of these technologies has kind of reached as far as it can go.
Those problems have been solved.
Those problems are, and they're well solved. And so that kind of becomes irrelevant because you sort of assume you have that commodity taken care of. And you look at, okay, how do applications work? And when applications fail to work, why do they fail to work? And, 90% of the time they fail to work because the user, doesn't like those applications. They're too slow, the applications are, or they're hard to understand, or they fail, they actually crash.
Or they run on Windows.
Or they run on Windows. And, I mean, there's various reasons why applications fail. And if you look at the percentage of applications created to the number of applications successful, it's a very, that's a very big ratio. Mm-hmm. And yet you know that good applications can exist, because you see things like Skype, pop up, and Skype is nicely done. It's beautiful in so many ways. And it just gets, tremendous adoption and just, and then gets sold for $4 billion or whatever to eBay. And so you know that it is possible. And one of my rules, I'm talking about my engineering values, and one of my engineering values is that you have to be able to revise software quickly. You have to be able to observe what users are going through and understand their needs and revise in that fashion. And sometimes a lot of times the user doesn't know what they want because what they saw before was really bad, and they don't want that again. But they don't imagine what changes they can make. So an engineer becomes an enabler for being able to help them to see examples of what it could be.
Well, kind of the visionary engineer.
The visionary engineer, yeah. And so you have to very quickly and rapidly be able to create applications, try them, have users try them. User says, this is really nice, but if the button were over there and it were a different size or color and it did this other thing, that would really be cool. And you have to be able to just, go on into two lines, three lines. There it is. That's the kind of thing you want to be able to do. And to get that kind of leverage in software is difficult. So,
well, you definitely see this trend. I see it in two places. I go to the checkout counters at supermarkets, and they have a self-service line. Have you guys seen this? Where you scan the items and put them into the bag, and they charge you the same amount of money? What the heck? Why am I doing this? I guess it's supposed to be faster. But from that same kind of perspective, there's all sorts of, not to bash open source projects where people are doing the work, sharing other people. Companies are starting to get in this arena as well. Microsoft wants to start enabling the user population to make its software better. And it sounds like that's one direction or one way of getting this sort of this plan, do, study, act kind of mentality.
I think companies like Microsoft have a more difficult time doing it.
Google.
Yeah, Google's a good example of companies really trying to, they don't actually care about being embarrassed. They'll try something, and if it doesn't work, they learn something. And that's a really good attitude. I hope they can keep it as they grow massively, as they are right now. That really requires that, kind of at the top of the company, the founders of the company have that attitude. It's okay to fail. It's okay. Let's try experiments. Let's see what we can do to grab more market share. Yeah.
Definitely a good way to look at it. Because Microsoft, especially, I was reading an article in Wired last week about Ray,
Ozzy.
Yeah. He's taking over. And the contrast in style between the way Bill Gates approached reviews of products and the way Ray approaches reviews of products. And Bill's approach, from what you're saying, is the definite, you know, I don't want to put something out there that's going to make me look bad. Right? And it seems Ray is much more, maybe not willing to accept failure, but not quite as verbose in dealing with that sort of thing.
Yeah, Ray is a good guy. I mean, he was the kind of the visionary behind Lotus Notes, if you know. Someone here is a Domino user,
so
I remember.
So he's sitting over
there. There we go, yeah.
He's vibrating with...
He's sort of like, oh, yeah, Ray Ozzy. Yeah. And then he went on and created a file-sharing messaging system for the office that was funded by Microsoft. What was the name of that thing? Do you remember? Groove Technologies. And actually, that was sort of a competition to our iOS product, which, of course, they had much deeper pockets, those guys. So, yeah, he's a good guy. I haven't actually met him, you know, personally, so I don't know, you know, to what degree that will work for, you know, Microsoft. But you also have another problem with entrenchment in a company at large, which is the fact that you have a great deal, actually to a tremendous degree, products get locked in by user education. Okay, so for instance, I was really disgusted last year to find out that like the U.S. military uses Microsoft products. So they'll be on the battlefield and they'll use Microsoft, Outlook. They'll be using Microsoft Outlook to send their emails back and forth, and you know, on a battle-hardened, you know, laptop. It's really scary, especially when you see the specs for the delivery time of how quickly that email has to get to their side. You know, it's things like if it's less than 500, 500 bytes, they've got 2 minutes to get it delivered to their side. You know, it's like, oh wow, and these things would crash, and there's. And this is not just a little thing. It's this the contract to support that messaging system is a $9 billion contract.
Yes.
Okay, to take Outlook and to use it in the military and to run all the servers associated with it. It's this just huge gobbledygook of stuff, and it's very very. But I asked the guy, I said, why do they do this? And they said, because the guys know how to use it. You know, they've seen it before. They know what button to press. They don't have to guess. They don't have to get educated again. They know how to use it. We don't want to have to educate the, you know, 250,000 people again.
Wow.
So
that's a big... There's two things. I remember reading that the U.S. military developed an intelligence test that did not use any kind of language. Because back in the First World War... The literacy rate was so low, they had to assess people's ability based on pictograms and so forth to figure out, you know, where to place them and so forth. So that's a common thread in the military. The other piece, I lost my train of thought. Shoot. It was a good one, too. It'll come back. So this is, you've been to Amy West... I guess three or four times in the last few years?
Yeah, I think maybe three. Anyone counting? Three? Yeah.
Three.
Yeah, third time.
And yeah. I do remember the time you were here, I guess it was about 3 years ago, with you had actually like a demonstration with items moving across the screen.
Yeah, that was
interconnected.
Like 4 or 5 years ago, right?
When was it?
Third year. 99.
Was
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's a while back.
Was that 6 years ago?
Yeah, time warp.
Ouch. Yeah, whoa.
Yeah, we were over the other one.
Yeah. I've been at this hotel, though.
Yeah.
I've been here.
Yeah.
And then there was another one near some railroad tracks. It was really hard to get to because there was like railroad tracks. And how do you get there? You can't get there. I remember that. Sorry, I interrupted you. You were talking about...
No, oh. I'm just kind of meandering around. I mean, it's just so fascinating to have this conversation.
Yeah.
I personally, I like to turn the microphones off and go somewhere else and do this, but there's a lot of interested people here.
We need a fireplace over there is what we need. Sit around and throw some marshmallows or something.
So, okay, here's a good question I'm sure everyone's asking. So what does a guy who in the past has worked on neural...
physiology.
Neurophysiology has written multitasking operating systems before that wasn't a word in the English language. Worked in television, is trying to revolutionize. What do you do when you're not in front of a computer and not in front of us?
Most of the time, make wine.
No, he said make, not drink. Very clear.
Make and drink wine. Yeah, you have to try it. You have to test it in the barrel, you know. You kind of put it in a glass, you know, and then you use this thing called a thief. You know, this is the name of this. It's like a pipette that you put in. You pull out the wine, and it's a lot of work, you know. When we put in these grapes, we thought, you know, we'll let them grow, and they'll grow, and then we'll go out there and kind of collect the grapes, and somehow you make it into wine. You know, it's like, whoa.
You can't always trust those, Wine for Dummies books.
No. Yeah. But it takes some time, and then, you know, at certain times of year, it takes a lot more time. We just finished that part just a few weeks ago where, you know, we were very busy there for a while, just, as the wine, you know, you have to crush it, and there's all sorts of, you know, steps in the process of, you know, kind of fermenting it, and then moving to a secondary fermenter, and then you finally put it in the barrel, and you sort of hope for the best, you know, at that point. And
can we have some to try? Where is it?
Actually, I did bring some, but I don't have too much. I should have brought a case. I only brought two bottles. So
we'll save that for much later.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, anyone that's here at like midnight, maybe we'll break it open, you know. And,
Next time. You can set up a little booth.
Yeah, there we go. Sip some wine. Yeah.
Excellent. So do you have a running Amiga in your compound house?
Several running Amigas, yeah. Okay.
See Rich? He's gone.
Yeah. But do I always turn them on is the other question. You know, the biggest motivator actually these days for turning them on are lawyers that are seeking what they call prior art in patent cases. So often companies are getting sued, and they're getting sued by a patent that was issued many years after the Amiga did the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so they need to prove that
inverted cursor that Microsoft tried to patent.
There's the one I did most recently was a $500 million lawsuit, and it had to do with the technology that was in CDTV, and the company patented it in 1993, and they didn't think there was any prior art, and the patent office couldn't find any prior art because CDTV, you know, really never became mainstream enough for people to know, but it was published. It was a product that was built. It was out there. Totally proved that technology. And wow. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that Amiga just, you know, proves just left and right. I mean, it goes on and on and on. All of us that were engineers at Amiga get those calls, you know, constantly from, you know, lawyers saying, "Oh, you know, I got someone getting sued."
Do you see as the patent system today, the IP protection as a benefit or a boon?
No, it's totally a scam. It's totally a scam. The patent system is completely broken for software. I mean, beyond reasonableness. Okay, and it's because the patent office often hires young engineers out of college. They have no idea of computing history. You know, as far as they're concerned, it was Apple and Microsoft the whole way.
Yeah.
You know, because they watched some PBS special that never even mentioned Commodore or whatever. You know, got to get my hit in on that one. It's like. One I saw recently because some investors like pointed out to us was Intel recently patented the concept of the virtual machine kinds of ideas that we use for writing and, you know, interpreters, you know, language interpretation. They patent the concept that was the language Forth. Which was like from 1965 or something, you know, when Charles Moore invented it, you know. So.
Wow. And I mean, Sun uses Forth in their open boot code. It's not that hidden.
Yeah. Well, it's because the books that were written about Forth, I mean, there's a great book called Threaded Interpretive Languages, is so long out of print that the patent office was probably never even, you know, they didn't find it on the internet when they did whatever the scan is they did and whatever searches they did. They just never found that particular description of it. But you see a lot of that kind of stuff happening,
yeah.
And it's just infuriating to someone like me because I have the opposite sort of attitude. You know, I mean, I only patent something if I'm kind of forced to, because first of all, a lot of work, and second of all, I don't really, unless it's just like the most amazing thing, like this alien number thing. That's so. So that you can patent. Okay, go ahead. It's Harvard patent. Yeah, and the rest of it is just scams, and they're very difficult for the small software developer because you need to have deep pockets. When you come up against someone who does have a patent, they often have a lot of money behind prosecuting the infringers of the patent. And as a matter of fact, one of the companies that does that is, the tobacco lawsuit that made, like $3 billion off that lawsuit, and they won? That's a company that goes around buying patents now. And they go after, and they use those, they buy ones where they think there's just really deep pockets behind, it's like an Oracle or, yeah. Or HP or something, and then they go after them, try to make as much money as they can off of the patent idea.
Well, I saw you have a BlackBerry. I mean, you look what happened with RIM and NTP.
Yeah.
I mean, RIM was basically in a holding pattern for almost a year.
Yeah.
Until the patent issue was resolved, and it actually gave their competition a chance to catch up.
Yeah, and they paid a lot of money for that for that patent. So yeah, there's things, evil things like that in the world, and we need to use. That's why it's actually, when I see piles of games and utilities and things like back on that table there, I look at that and I say, oh, please preserve that. I mean, save it because there's like probably 10 patents in that pile that have been filed since those things did that.
Yeah,
like in one of the last ones I did, it was actually like on a Fred Fish disk that someone did a program that disproved, that proved that the idea had been thought of in advance. There was one like that, and digging around for that took a while. I mean, there's a lot of digging going on. The one of the patent firms that I've worked with has a museum basically that they keep. It's about half the size of that room over there. And you go in that museum, and what they do is they collect old technologies and they keep them so that they have them when they need them for a case. And you go in there, and 90% of it's Amiga stuff. I mean, it's Amiga 3000s, Amiga 500s, Amiga 1000s, Amiga monitors, things that plug into Amigas. I mean, it's like, well, things that plug into Amiga, really good example. What's that? Oh, Joyboard, yeah. No, it's like one of the first things I did after I left Amiga was a company in Texas wanted to connect. They wanted to connect a hard drive. It was one of the very first hard drives and plugged into the parallel port. Remember the company name? A couple guys in Texas actually worked really well. I wrote the drivers for it.
On the Amiga.
And anyway, connected to the parallel port and the... parallel port communicated with a hard drive.
If you know the answer, Brian, please call. He's listening on the East Coast. He probably has one. We'll call in a minute.
So I think it was Hewlett Packard that contacted me on that, and they were getting sued because someone had this patent on doing the running a hard disk through the parallel port, and it was done like 3 years after the date that I did it on the. On the Amiga.
Oh, you can almost make a business selling your knowledge.
Yeah, yes, you do. You do make a business. And I sold them. Actually, I had the prototype right there. And, it was all, you can see how plugged into the, and I even had the brochure that they came out with. and I sold it to them for a really good profit.
So they could prove the prior art.
So they could prove the prior art, yeah.
Wow.
But, I just have to warn you on that. I mean, you have to be very careful because if you put the price too high, they'll just basically subpoena you to testify, so you can't retire, but you can buy nice motorcycle or car or something.
Excellent. Or more wine bottles.
More wine bottles, exactly. They're very expensive.
Of course. Yeah. Wow. What time is it anyway? It's 9:17. What time do we have to get out of here? Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does anyone want to take a break or keep going? Keep going?
Hold on. Brian's calling.
Oh.
Byte by Byte A Limited?
There's another one.
That was a different one.
Yeah, a different one. It's before that. Yeah. They did have one, but there was
did
another
you
one.
One of those?
There was one.
Stock? He does have one.
He's rich.
What's that?
Yeah, they had one. Yeah.
did the Byte by
No, it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't Brad Harvey.
Okay,
yeah.
It was someone else. Okay, yeah. Well, good try. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, Texas. A small company. Let's see. They made an expansion card as well. Oh, well. You know, sort of. No. You'll recognize it once I remember it. But it may be, no. They were in Richardson, Texas. How's that for, you know, how the brain works? Yeah. Definitely alien. Yeah. Anyway.
So I think the Amiga community looks to the forefathers, Dale and RJ and yourself and many others of the original team is kind of, I'll use the term rock stars. Anyone disagree with that? I'm not seeing you disagree. When did that first happen? Like, when did you go from, coder in the corner to walk into a room and go, oh, my God, these people, like, want to know things about a fish?
Yeah.
Don't you want to know how this works about, you know, interrupts and all this stuff? Like, no, tell us about the fish.
You know, I think a lot of people maybe, you know, they don't get appreciated until after they're dead. But actually, it happened really early for us because I think the first DevCon, you know, when we showed, you know, I don't know if any of you were at the very first Amiga Developers Conference, but it was down in Monterey, and you know, we got there and gave our presentations and gave demos of the machine, and people just were, you know, I mean, it's just totally blown away, so very quickly, you know, they were like, how did you do that? You know, how does this machine do that? There were a lot of those kinds of questions, you know, coming in, and sort of really deep appreciation for, you know, what we'd achieved as a very small team, really. So.
Well, from the stories we've heard tonight and elsewhere, it sounds like almost to a person there was passion about what they were working on, whether it was a little green light on a monitor or a single bit in a chip. And I think, going back to the alien theories, I don't think it was aliens. I think he did it. He seems like a really smart guy. He seems human.
Those alien numbers were very convincing.
But there's always this talk, and especially if you look around Silicon Valley, everyone wants that, the next big thing. How do you get that? I came from a company that had a really great start. I don't think it was quite as fantastic, as magical, if you will. But there's other companies that spawned off, and they're trying to get that kind of magic. And they focus more on trying to make it that way than on what they're trying to do. And I think that at the end of the day, that's what matters, is to get a group of people together who, for lack of reason or anything else, have a passion and they go for that.
Yeah, you know, it's very true, and it's definitely a synergy. I think one of the secrets to Amiga was that in the first 2 years, we were in a little room that was like half the size of that room over there. I keep saying that. Alien technology. It's like alien, I don't know, it's one of those numbers. Anyway, very small room. The software guys were one room.
What was the address?
Oh, man. No, that was not in Los Gatos. That was actually in Sunnyvale over in one of those old kind of, you know, beat-up kind of buildings. It was, you know, we hadn't even met Commodore money. You know, we were just running off of this money that some doctors had donated or, you know, had invested.
The famous dentist.
The famous, you know, I think it was like $12 million for 2 years with, you know, a company of, ended up being like 60 people or something. Yeah, no, it was tremendous synergy. And actually, you don't think about it. It's probably not written in that book. But one of the things was we were all the software guys were in one room, okay? And I was over in my corner, and I had, you know, it's called HP, it was H Development System for 68,000. Does anyone here remember
DMS?
The name of it?
No.
Anyway, it was essentially an emulator and a tracer combined, and it was really big and expensive, and you basically could use it to replace the processor. So you could essentially step through and watch all the instructions and see all the timing on everything. And there I was working on the operating system, and next to me there was Dale Luck, and he was working on the graphics. Okay, and when he would do his little thing on the graphics and bring up some amazing pattern on the screen, bing, there I'd look up, wow, nice looking graphics, you know. And then behind me was RJ working on his stuff, and the sound guy, Sam Dicker, was right across, and he had these really nice speakers and this really nice amplifier, okay, and he'd play some dung, dung, kind of like sound like this, you know. It's like, wow, you know, how did you do that? You know, see the formula for that sound. And And so by being in the same room, we kind of, it wasn't really a competition as much, it was just inspiring to be near each other to see what we were doing. And you sort of say, well, what did I show? Okay, because, you know, I didn't have graphics on the screen, I wasn't making cool sounds, all that kind of stuff. And what I was doing is, that's when I was creating like the concept of libraries, because it was a really difficult problem. They were all working on separate systems. Okay, and up to that point, the way you created a ROM was you all got together at one build, and you took all of your software together, and you compiled it all at the same time, and you linked it all together, and you put it into ROM. Okay, and I thought, this is never going to work. Never going to work. Everyone's like working independently on things. I've got to invent a system so that we can do it totally independent, so I can make my changes to the operating system, and RJ can do his stuff, and Dale can do his stuff, and Sam can do his stuff, and you know, Kodiak can do his stuff, and they can just go ahead and run on whatever as we did without having to link to it again. And so I got to come up with a model for that, for libraries, and so that came really early on, was a library thing, because it helped us develop faster. And then device drivers, the same thing. Mm-hmm. And Autodocs came because I noticed no one was documenting anything. Okay. And I said, you know, this is really going to be a problem. And we had a documentation guy that was actually hired really early on, Rob Peck. And Rob was going insane. I mean, he was just going totally insane because he couldn't get any of our time. We just would not spare a cycle for the poor guy. And so he was sitting there just, you know, really frustrated. And I said, well, let's do this, you know. And I created the Autodoc standard. And I did all my code Autodoc'd. And then I wrote the little program that, you know, printed it all out in those summaries. And the other guys looked at it, and it's like, RJ's like, yeah, this is great. And, you know, Sam, yeah, let's do this. And Dale was like, So we all kind of ganged up on Dale. You know? Kind of circled him and was like, you're going to do this, you know. And it happened, and as a result, those manuals, when they came out on the release, were really an amazing accomplishment, because they, and the thing about Autodocs that a lot of people don't appreciate is, when you do it in that fashion, the documentation is always there with the code. So as you change things in the code, as you change the interface to the function, you change the operation of the function, you just go make a couple line change above, and you're done. You don't have to go off to find another document somewhere or whatever. And so it really made for this just... It was very practical, you know, solution to that problem, and that was again, you know, something that, so those kinds of things, you know, helped them appreciate what was going on, and you know, yeah, it was built on that.
Wow, it sounds like it was a phenomenal work environment.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't so phenomenal in terms of the. I mean, it was really a cave, and it was really very unpleasant. You know, late at night and stuff. It had no windows. You didn't know it was day or night. You know, I mean, there was you know, it was very crowded. I mean, they kept putting more and more people into that same room. The QA guys got moved into that same room. We were putting more and more desks, and you had to squeeze through, and it was really tight and all this kind of stuff. And our machines that we were developing on were, you know, we didn't have a lot of money for anything. And so, you know, they were using these computers called Sage. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of a Sage 68000 computer, but it was a very small company, sort of like the companies that make, you know, hardware for, well, there aren't any. The hardware companies for Amiga, I was going to say, these days. But basically, they would make, you know, very small unit, number of units, but it was a 68000 processor, which was very important. It had a compiler, and of course, then we went out and bought our own compiler. And so they were using these things to write code for the Amiga, which wasn't running yet as of that point, to really get a head start on it for when it was going to be available. And then when Commodore came in, that just totally changed. Because all of a sudden, it's like, what do you need?
Yeah.
And since I'd had previous experience with the founder of Sun Microsystems, I said, we need Sun Microsystems. And so we all got, you know, Suns, and we probably spent, you know, 3 months just, you know, doing that, just setting up our Suns and porting the compiler to the Sun, which was a fun project. So...
It's always interesting how money changes things,
yeah.
For the good and for the bad.
It can definitely be a problem. You know, you were mentioning earlier the Intel Duo chip, and what's funny is the project I was working on at Apple was a real super secret project at the time, and now it's no longer super secret, so I can talk about it.
Enterprise?
No, this is at Apple.
Yeah, no, but was it the Enterprise project? Was that
no.
The code name?
Okay. No, yeah, and... It was a project that we were in the building with the Cray, okay, and there was a really good reason we were in the building with the Cray, because we were designing a essentially parallel processor, and it was a it had essentially four CPUs on the same chip. Okay, and it had a very large associative cache in the middle, and these each of these chips could run out of that cache simultaneously. So I think they call it, I think it's called, called four-way set associative, I think is what it was called. And it had like a cache line of, oh, I don't know, it's really big. It's like 256 bits or something like that. And anyway, it's you know, when you simulated it, you need to have a really powerful computer to simulate this thing. So that's what the Cray was for, was to simulate that chip. But that was in 1986.
Oh, wow.
Okay, that we were creating that and doing benchmarks and trying to determine, you know, will a chip that has, you know, four processors on it really do that well? And actually, they Apple had done a really smart thing. They'd hired all these guys from, it's called the Aquarius Project. There, see, that's the access, memory access time there. It's called the Aquarius Project. And the guys had all come from what do you call it, large-scale computing types of things, supercomputer, you know, projects from different companies. And so the hardware designers were all really familiar with how do you interleave and tessellate memory to be able to get those kind of fetch times out of memory and all that kind of stuff in order to feed the cache fast enough to get a chip that was running really close to the speed of a Cray back in 86, 87 time frame.
Right.
And, you know, so...
It doesn't sound like that ever came to market, though.
No, it didn't. It self-destructed, as you know. But actually, the reason I was bringing that up, I was trying to think of why I put that in there, which was that project had too much money. Because if the first thing you say is, ah, we've got $50 million, let's buy a Cray.
You know? I was going to say, when you said we have a Cray for this project, that's a little excessive.
A Cray is not something you just sort of plug into the wall socket. I mean, there the mechanical room that runs the cooling system on the Cray is as big as that room over there. Okay. And takes as much power as 150 households. You know, I mean, that's the size of that thing. And it has a cooling tower. That's how you knew a building are. You know, it's like, come to the building with the plume coming out of the top. That's our building.
And they hire an engineer for you, lives nearby, just in case there's a problem.
So that was like too much money. The guys in the room that are hardware designers will laugh at the reason I actually, you know, quit was so they're going along really well on the hardware design, and we're talking about the instruction set and trying to get it optimized and getting a lot of kind of philosophical arguments about what is the best instruction set, because when you're building something like that, you know, and back then it really wasn't quite known yet. Well, do you want to go the RISC design, or do you want more complex than that? Do you want to go with bytes? You know, do you want to go with, you know, long words? I mean, what do you want to do? And a lot of new things would come out, like the very large word formats. So there's a lot of debate. Well, how do you do this? And so then you try to make that chip, okay, which was a very complicated process back then. It was like really pushing the art. And the foundry that they picked was AT&T. Apparently, back then they were the place to go for the chip technology that we needed. And the first thing the AT&T engineers came in, we were running all the design tools for the hardware were running on the VACs, where they'd been well perfected, and the VACs, you know, was running all these design tools. First thing AT&T said is, let's port the design tools to the Cray. They'll run faster. And I put in my resignation within an hour because what you don't know is that a Cray has a very strange word. Okay, the addressing of memory is not, it's not just like, you know, byte addressable. Okay, it's Cray word addressable, where if you want to address bytes, those are in the upper two bits of the word. Okay, so if you're doing like pointer comparison and you're only off by one byte, that will show that will be the difference between negative and positive, you know, integer kind of thing. So if you're writing C code, and if all these design tools were written in C code, the thing is, you just can't port it. I mean, well, you could, but it's going to take a long time. That's going to take as long as making the chips, you know. So it, you know, it's interesting how things like that happen. You know, there's like, you know, certain decisions are good decisions, and then you hit something like that, and it's like, and I tried to, I went over and I said, this is a, you know, I tried to, you know, change it. I always try to change things before I leave. It's like, you've got to change it.
The popcorn wasn't working.
No, popcorn didn't work on that one. No, I don't know why they and so within, you know, I think, within a year, probably 20 people bailed from that project.
Wow.
And then within, you know, a year and a half, I think it was dead. So,
It's sad because it sounds like it was very interesting.
It was very interesting. The reason it was super secret was because the relationship between Apple and Motorola had always been really sacred, you know, to get the pricing they wanted and that kind of thing. And so, and there weren't, you know, that many second sources for those chips. So they really wanted to guard that. They didn't want Motorola to know that we were up to this. So, yeah.
I think we have a question from the audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the question was, you just come from Amiga to Apple. Yeah. Why were you working on theoretical processors on Cray's and not working on the actual OS?
Especially with what they had as an OS.
Yeah, it was a really weird experience for me. I tell you, to go from a really super passionate project like Amiga, where I didn't want to leave Amiga. I mean, I had my first kind of contact with Commodore, and I thought, this doesn't feel right to me. You know, there's something wrong with this company. And then over the years of, you know, over actually it was a fairly short period of time, I'd say. And after the Amiga, you know, got released, we got the release out, and then within a few months, you know, it's just obvious to me. You know, I was trying to get them to kind of go to the next generation of Amiga. In other words, you've got to start your next generation as soon as you finish your first one. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons I think that the Amiga had a struggle, because it should have, within a couple years, improved the quality of the color. You know, it should have improved the quality of the sound. I mean, those, as you think back, you know, it's like it was great for the time, but the rest of the world was catching up very quickly. You know, and so you need to start right away. Let's start on the next one. What your question was? Oh, environment.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, you can imagine what it was like. Okay, so here was Mr. Multitasking going to work for Apple, you know, company unmultitasking, essentially. And that was one of the first things I tried to change. I went to their advanced technology group, okay, and they kind of recruited me to go there. And the advanced technology group was the cream of the crop of the Valley back then. I mean, that was, you know, Alan Kay, you know, was there, and all these kind. I mean, we just had, you know, Evans and Sutherland, you know, worked there. I mean, all these guys, it was like the best of the best were at this group. And so I wanted to work with these guys. And our mission in life wasn't just theoretical like a lot of labs, AT&T Labs or Hewlett-Packard Labs. It was to try to make things and then try to sell them into the production divisions of the rest of Apple. You know, and they would sometimes come by and we'd review their work, you know, we'd review kind of their concepts. But it was a really difficult thing for me, because when I got there, I found out by talking to a lot of people at Apple that Apple was totally, they were totally floored and very, very worried about the Amiga, okay? Because it came out, had these tremendous abilities, you know, its color, its multitasking, its all this stuff. And the engineers there, they, you know, Jobs was like, let's go, we're going to do the Macintosh. But all the engineers were like, oh my God, look what we're up against. They just thought it would totally crush them. Because remember, prior to that, it was Apple II and Apple IIe, which the Amiga just, you know, just totally blew away. Different price, kind of price point, but still, it was an amazing thing. So they thought, we're dead. You know, our cash cow is the Apple II. And so it was funny to work around there for a while. You know, they all knew I was from Amiga. And it was weird for me too. I kind of felt like traitor or something. You know, I felt a little dirty. You know, going over to the other side. You know, and you, well, it wasn't Atari. Yeah, I could never work for Atari. So yeah, it was hard for me. But we tried to influence. And I'll never forget this meeting where we were talking about the future of the Macintosh operating system. And it was like, how do we get to true multitasking was the topic. Okay, we had a room that was, there's probably 10 guys from the Macintosh operating system group and me, you know. And I'm saying, okay, here's how you do it. Unfortunately, because you do not have a preemptive model, in other words, you can't just go in and interrupt software anywhere, your whole operating system is toast. Okay, you have to make a major break in the operating system. In other words, you're going to have to essentially almost break everything in order to become preemptive. And that's just the rule. That's just it's like a law of nature that you have to do that. And of course, they didn't want to hear that. And so I drew this diagram on the board where it's like, here you are now, and here you have to be. And the guy that was a project manager, no, you know, this is from the production division. No, you don't have to do that. We'll just go in these little steps. Each year, we'll break 10% of the software, and then we'll break another 10% of the software. Then we'll break another 10% of it. Like this, and he put these steps. I said, no, you can't do that. That's not how this works. That's just not, it's not theoretically possible to do, to make this change that way. And for, you know, and I was 99% sure that my statement was correct. And so for years and years, even after I left Apple, I kept watching the Macintosh. Like, can they do it? Can they do it? Can they do it? No. OS 10. You know, that's what they had to do, break everything, sort of. Yeah. Yeah, well, they came up with a way of running within the environment of OS 10 for those other things. And that was a good solution. That was a really good solution to it.
Which is precisely what we're doing now with the Amiga when it comes to custom chips. You know, if you want to run that stuff, you got to go to UAE because it's disruptive. It's just too disruptive and forward.
Yeah, yeah, and unfortunately, you don't have a lot of the applications that you use are no longer supported by the vendors.
Absolutely not.
And they're precious applications to you, and you don't want to break them because there's no way to get them fixed or recompiled or anything. So, you know, you're stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously the model wasn't broken. It just didn't anticipate a 12-year dry spell of development. It makes it more difficult.
Well, I mean, it's a 21-year life now at this point. I mean, 21 years after the... And in a lot of ways, a lot of it's the same.
Yeah.
You know, I mean...
Some of those monitors over there are the same.
Yes, those monitors definitely the same over there. But, you know, I mean, the way exec works, actually someone mentioned the memory the memory allocation thing. I wanted to fix this little typo. They're mentioning that the...
he's a slab allocator.
Oh, I think it's Richard. Is he here?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. You mentioned the allocator and then the fact that the allocator was slow on exec. And actually that allocator, if you read that blue book over there, what you'll find is that allocator was never meant to be the application allocator. That memory allocator was designed for libraries and devices to do very rough allocations, and then they would subdivide that memory and manage it with a better algorithm. I don't know how many people know, but there was supposed to be another layer. You know, you had the exec, and then you had the Amiga DOS on top of it, which was a horrible thing. I mean, it was just a really... The DOS part of Amiga came from England, and it was just not... It was not good. It was very, very nasty. Written in this very strange language, BCPL. And what's that? BCPL?
No. DOS.
No. A guy named Tim King wrote it from Edinburgh.
It's Scottish.
Huh? Yeah, he's from Edinburgh. Scottish, yeah. Any Scots in the... there was one here yesterday. He's talking under the table. So, yeah, Scottish operating system. And I looked at it, and I was like, oh, man, and this is really bad. But what was, we had hired a company in Arizona to do the higher levels, to do the file system and to do more of some of the more details of the process environment, okay, because we just didn't have, you know, I didn't have enough time to do it. And so we were going with these guys, and they were doing kind of more of a Unix style to like how the file system worked, and it was actually looking pretty good. And all of the API functions were named appropriately, like open to open, you know, a file and that kind of thing. And then in walks this guy, says, "Oh, I can run on your I can run right now," you know. And he just in like a few weeks, he had ported his kind of crude operating system layers onto, kind of glommed them onto the top of exec, and he showed it to the management, you know, to Jay and Dave, and what they saw is something running. He said, "Oh, this runs, this works, you know, I can do some file transfers." And you know, I was so horrified by this that I talked to a guy that was one of the guys that did the floppy disk device driver, Neil Caton. And I said, "Neil, we've got to go. We've got to, you know, rewrite, and we've got to rewrite an entire operating system in like 60 days." And so we wrote a spec up very quickly, and we went to, you know, Jay and Dave, and we said, "You do not want this DOS. We'll write you one in 60 days. We'll lock ourselves in a closet. You know, we won't eat any food or whatever. You can put food through the door. We don't care what it takes. We're going to write a different operating system, you know, for these higher layers, because this one is really going to be bad news." And we lost that. You know, it was kind of like, no, you know, there's not time and not resource. You can't do that. And so that's when I took Tim King and we went off site to a hotel, and I said, "You will not call open." You know, it was called something like, it was just the weirdest name. It was not open. It was like, you know, a redirect file handle or something like this was the name of the open function. So I went through and renamed all of his APIs so that someone can have a chance of understanding what the heck this stuff was. And the rest is history. I mean, it was only a month after I left Commodore that I got a call from, it was actually from Irving Gould himself. He says, "You got to come back." We went to Germany to build the Amiga, you know, 2000 stuff. 2000A. And Braunschweig. And they really think the DOS sucks. Really bad. It's horrible. You've got to come back. And he says, "Pick a bank where you want money deposited, and I'll deposit any reasonable sum of money in that bank. But as long as you come back, go to Germany, I'll fix everything." And I said, "No, I can't do it. I can't do it. It's too broken. It's gone now. You know, it's like, it's out there. People have done their applications. You know, I mean, there was like, I don't know, 20 applications or whatever that had been done. But in retrospect, it was a huge mistake on my part. I should have just broken everything and fixed it at that point. And we would have had a much nicer system in that arena. I'm not sure how many of you are programmers have experienced the elegance or the unelegance of the internals of the file system and all of that.
I wish Olaf was here.
Oh, Olaf, yeah, I'm sure he would. Well, the poor people that had to support that stuff later, you know, that had to try to make it decent.
Well, I'm thinking the OS4 developers who are trying to go from that horrific language to C.
Yeah, well, that was done by Commodore. They basically, over the years, converted pretty much everything out of BCPL because it was just too difficult. But there were some, you know, just like the big Indian, little Indian thing, there were some things that BCPL imposed on the design. For instance, the fact that it addressed actually 32-bit words, okay, in its addressing scheme of the language, not bytes, okay? So that's why if you look at the code, you'll often see, okay, you're going into the file system and you have to shift your addresses over. You do all your stuff, you come back, you have to shift your addresses back over, okay, because they're essentially in a different address space. They're in a different address representation, that of long word addressing, so... So those were just horrible things. I mean, you know, and if you didn't know that and you were a developer and you didn't know you needed to shift that address over and you called a function, just boom, you know, guru meditation right now.
Mm-hmm. So we gave away we had a raffle for a Joyboard earlier today, and you just mentioned the guru meditation.
Yeah.
You wanted to describe the relationship between those products, if it existed?
Oh, yeah. Did I mention that earlier?
The guru meditation?
Oh, between what products?
Well, the Joyboard.
Joyboard.
And how the guru came about and how software failure.
Well, but those are separate stories.
Well, let's hear.
Oh, okay.
I got time.
Well, the Joyboard came as sort of a, this is, you know, Amiga, I think I mentioned earlier, right? Amiga was submarining. Okay, it was submarining, trying to look like a different company, but it needed to develop distribution channels for its products because that took. There was a long time lead time on that. You know, just like there is. You know, any of you have been retailers know about that, and so they needed to develop some products, and so they developed. They decided, we'll make some joysticks. Those would be cheap. You know, we can afford a few molds and make some joysticks. And Atari was big, and Jay Miner knew exactly what kind of joystick would sell well in that market. Some nice little palm joystick thing, and then the idea came, you know, to do this Joyboard thing. I was like, wow, this is great. You can do surfing, you can do, you know, skiing, and just all these different game ideas. And so they started making that thing, and they created, Amiga actually created several games and had them produced for the Atari. That Surf's Up, is that one of them?
I have that.
You have that? Yeah. And there was another one that was a skiing one where you kind of shooshed. Yeah, Alpine skiing? Yeah. And that guy was always coming in, you know, using our nice NTSC monitors to look at his game, and it would always like crash and stuff. But that's where that board, you know, kind of came out of. But it wasn't really as big a hit as I thought, and it's because it does have kind of one problem, which is if you put it on a carpet, I mean that it's only like that far off the surface, and it sort of sinks into the carpet, and it doesn't work. And so you really have to have the right surface for it. It's not really an excellent design in terms of its mechanics. So that's the story of that. The guru meditation is a totally different thing, which was, I was thinking of developers when I was doing, exec. It's like, I got to make it easy for these guys to do different things. And I got to, it's like, I got to somehow, when I get an exception is, the code blows out, something crashes. I've got to somehow tell the developer something. It's like, help, Somehow I got to get that message out. And up to that point, if you remember what things did at that time, the IBM PC just went dark, crashed. Okay, and that was it. Boom, it's gone. It's dead. Like, power just died. And I thought, that's no good. You just can't do that, to people. So I thought, well, I'll catch the exception, and I'll send out this little cry for help. And so I put it up, and the first thing, I used my, what we did on the HP 3000 MPE operating system is the message that used to be come up was called sudden death. So it's a sudden death 909 or something, that's really bad. I thought, well, I can do that. I can put up sudden death and the little number, I'll give sort of, a little bit of an indication where, process, where the PC, the program counter was and that kind of thing. And the exception number encoded. And make it kind of, reddish and blink and, kind of make it look scary. And then I looked at it, I thought, what? For most people, this is just a horrible experience. It's like you're using your computer, and all of a sudden it goes red and blinks at you with something that says sudden death. I thought, wow, that's going to make a lot of people unhappy. And I thought, well, what can I do? Well, I didn't have a lot of time. I thought, I'll just change what the message is. And I thought, well, with someone looking at this, most people looking at this would have no idea what these numbers are. And it's like even someone who kind of knows what, something about computing, and programming would look at these and understand what these numbers are. So I thought, only a guru would know what these numbers are. And they're going to have to think about it for a long time. So I put this guru meditation thing in there. Well, so I put it in there, and then we did the next build, the operating system. And someone in management, at that point we're under Commodore's management. Someone in the management was using Amiga, and it crashed, and it came with guru meditation. And they were really unhappy. It's like, what does that mean? It's like this is horrible, and it's like we've got to change that message right now. So they came to me and they said, you can't use this message. This message out of question is just not the kind of thing that users want to see, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, you gotta have a sense of humor about this crash. And it's like, no sense of humor. You gotta take it out. So I said, oh, okay, I'll take it out. So the next build, I took it out. And I swear it was within an hour. Like RJ and Dale and everyone was like at my door. Where's the guru meditation? Why doesn't it say that anymore? And so I said, well, here's the story. I told them about management. Okay, let's go in together. We'll all gang up and we'll just go down there. We'll tell them, no, we're going to put the guru back. So we went down and we said, you don't have a choice. We're putting the guru back in there. So we did, and that's history. So it was fun.
So what about the rumor about the guru is that you introduce it like every time the Amiga crashed during development, it was kind of a therapy.
To meditate on? Yeah. Well, I mean, there was a lot of meditating going on. At that point in the development of the Amiga, most of the software was totally, it was really 99% done. And what you know from software, a software person saying it's 99% done, is it's a long ways off because it needs to be debugged. Yeah. And the debugging at that point in open memory, in other words, not memory protected process multitasking environment, is hell. Okay? Because you have some process way over here that's running the keyboard, and it decides it's going to write way over here into some graphics process that's going to change some pointer that hits exec, and now you crash. And it's like, how did that happen? And so you spent hours and hours and hours on a state analyzer, looking through every single instruction, and they're being multiplexed because of the, multitasking going on to try to find those kind of bugs. So it may take, for some of those bugs, probably the worst bugs during development would take a week of solid time of my time to find why the Amiga crashed. And so, yeah, that's a meditation, definitely.
And the Amiga actually still cries for help, because help, it's four letters. It's one long word that is written into address number zero.
Yeah. I did that to, essentially that cry for help was to block the, there's a jump instruction down there that used to be there that I don't know if, how many of you know that, but it's, was that, yeah, it was a reset vector. There was a reset vector that went down there. There's also exec base pointers at four, you know. And there was, right before that was a jump instruction. And I forget why the jump instruction was in there at this point, but the, I wanted to knock that out, and I also wanted to give, you know, on a state analyzer, we're just like looking at, you know, hex dumps. You know, you, the first thing you go look is that help in there, that kind of thing, you know. And so I'd forgotten about that. Boy, it's amazing. It's amazing how many little things in there.
We found that using Enforcer.
Yeah.
Enforcer came a lot later, I guess.
Yeah, it did.
Enforcer was...
Bryce.
The big step between 1.3 and 2.0.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a nice tool, Enforcer. Bryce, I think, wrote that, and that was just an excellent thing. Or it was maybe Mike Sins. The other thing that a lot of people didn't know was that you could hook to the serial port.
Yeah.
And if you knew the right magic, it would pop the serial port would pop open a little mini WAC, you know. And WAC was the little debugger, and you can kind of snoop around memory a little bit and see what's in there.
That's what we did with the multi-disc device, the device that replaces TrackDisk device for the CatWeasel. That's how we found out of all those details, especially the help message.
Yeah, the microphone. They can't hear you.
I was just saying that we used the Enforcer and also that serial link to debug the multi-disc device, which is the CatWeasel driver. And we got quite a laugh out of the when we finally found out what has been written into address number zero, because we were thinking, none of our pointers points to zero, and nothing there, but there is something. It's just these four bytes getting overwritten, and it took us quite a while to see. Well, it might be ASCII. Come on, let's try it. Let's try. And then we've seen this help. Hey, Amiga's crying for help. Yeah.
That's great.
I like to see stuff like that. I mean, you know, all those things are. No, I haven't. I actually haven't looked at the code. I mean, there was a time when I used to, you know, anyone would come up with something like exec or whatever, I'd go look at it and sort of examine it. And there was one point where someone wrote a reverse assembly of exec. And actually what they did is rather than, they felt it was copyright infringement to actually do it. So they gave you a tool which did the reverse assembly and then commented every line, you know. And that was really fun to see because there were, you know, things were positioned in memory for really good reasons. And if you look, one of the fun things was actually my name is encoded in a matrix inside of exec. And I don't know how many people, you know that, but it's actually an ASCII matrix turned sideways. And it's right in the middle of the scheduler. Okay, so if you're looking right at the task scheduler, you'll see it just at one point skips a few bytes. You know, or actually it didn't even have to skip it. It was actually between some interrupt vector processors. But embedded in there was this thing. And the reason I put that in there, and it's just like, you know, people who, you know, would disassemble it was like, what are these weird bytes doing in here? But I'd heard of a copyright infringement case where it was actually like for the Sinclair or something, or one of these other, or maybe it was an Osborne, where they proved that the ROM had been copied rather than clean room designed because the developer had put his name into the code. And that was the proof because it's totally unnecessary. It doesn't even need to be in there. So I was really disappointed when Bryce took it out. So he was like, "What are these bytes doing in here?" You know, delete. Oh, it still works. Okay, good.
I mean, we talked earlier about protection of patents and ideas and so forth, and I think that's a common trick is to put little signature pieces in there so that when you look at it and say, "No, if it has this, then it's my work."
Yeah. Well, and what we did on CDTV was really interesting. We took the CDTV-like image, and we took the device driver itself, Okay, and what else was it? Basically, what we achieved in a single work was a trademark, a copyright, and a patent protection, all within the same method. It was kind of a cool little trick, and that's that secret key you need on CDTVs. If you make a CDTV CD-ROM, it won't run. You need a special little key to enable it, and that's the key, is that thing. So you can't, you know, you can't say, oh, I just clean room designed that.
Because
you know,
it's patented.
It all goes together. It's like, you know, we wanted to have multiple tracks for, that was Irving's idea, actually. Not to do it that way, but to have some way to protect CDTV from developers just, you know, randomly, you know, producing things for it, which I thought was actually a really good idea to be able to just randomly produce things for CDTV, but the business model is different for that product.
Yeah. It's a good thing you don't work for Microsoft, because I'm sure people with the Xbox would be very upset. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it is 10. So we fulfilled our obligation. Yeah. I know we could use a break. do you want to take back the mic and wrap the things up?
Just for a few things. How many of you enjoyed it? Looks like you're all still here. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure that's just the tip of the iceberg, really. Great to hear, you know, what's behind, you know, some of the human things that are behind this piece of machinery that we all just can't do without, obviously, or else we would be at this point. Now, one of the other things, kind of a next year thing, that instead of surveying you all by email and hoping that you send it back, which doesn't really work too well, is to see if this date, this around this date, is a good date for MU West. Do you guys like the date? See a show of hands. Okay. Good. We need to take MU West to Deutschland and do Oktoberfest sometime. That would be a lot of fun. probably won't happen in the next year, but maybe year after. That'd be a lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah. There you go. And that would be something that would probably be, you know, conditioned on that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And see, that's one of the... That's one of the reasons, that's one of the things behind the negotiations that Chuck does, is that we tell them now, and they give it to us at a greatly reduced rate. Since we can plan a year in advance, that's part of what keeps us going. So that was just something I wanted to find out, or we wanted to find out right now, is if October still works, then we'll probably shoot for October next year. And see what happens to it. The other thing is that we had very few advanced sales this time, ticket-wise, with most people buying their tickets at the door, which is great. I mean, it's not really a big deal for you guys. What it does for us is it helps us know how many people are coming. So the more you can buy in advance, and I'm talking about door ticket, you know, just to get in tickets, and the banquet tickets as well, the more you can do that, the better it works for us, just because we can prepare better. Right. In advance. Yeah. So if we could sort of bring it up to the banquet ticket level for the show tickets, that would help us a great deal too. We can take your money anytime during the year. That's not a problem. And so if you want to send it, we have our club address, which is on the back of the Amiga Zets and all over the internet at this point. And you can just, you know, send us a check or whatever you want to do. Oh, sure. Right, because we're not using your advance payments to pay against the hotel. One of the neat things about the first AMU West was that it gave us basically the advance funds to fund every other AMU West for the next 7 years. So and we're still running on that. So which is really kind of amazing. I think because we have done it on a nonprofit basis, nobody gets paid. You know, all of our club officers and everybody else, you know, we buy banquet tickets and show tickets as well. So, you know, nobody gets paid to do this. And I think that's one of the things that's kept us going. But just those few things. We have our, you know, our websites live all the time. I don't think we've ever had a server failure on that. Not that I recall. So that would be something that you can help us with. Now, another thing I wanted to just in closing, I know we had talked to, Carl and I had talked at breakfast this morning, quite by chance, about a new tutorial that is up for Rebel on rebel.com. Okay. On the left side, left-hand navigation bar? Okay. It says new tutorial. Okay. For those of you who are interested in programming and learning Rebel, there's a new tutorial up on rebel.com. We can hopefully get some feedback on that to Carl.
Yeah, that'd be great. Actually, I started writing it because I realized that over all these years that no one had really written a just kind of really fundamental sort of tutorial that was interesting but also informative and not too wordy. A lot of tutorials get very, very wordy, and you know by the time you get to an example, it's like you're already kind of like tired. But you know the. So yeah, let me know what you think of it. It's actually something it's kind of a work in progress that I've got three sections to it now, but I want to see how people like it. If people like it, then I'll write more sections on it if you think it's of value. So I've already started getting feedback from people saying that they like it. So hopefully, you know, anyone interested in that will like that too.
Yeah, I personally, just because I like the idea, would like to see, you know, more of a Rebel presence here next year too, so that we could do a seminar on Rebel and show people some of the things, even some of the older things like Vid, you know, what that does and how that works and all that nine yards.
It'd be really cool to have Rebel on OS 4, you know, and you
well,
know,
actually, actually
on
Steve,
the new hardware.
Yeah,
on
there
the,
you go.
That you're gonna make.
Yeah.
I'm going to twist your arm afterwards. You're going to do hardware.
Yeah.
I'll have a classic Amiga board next year, definitely.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Classic's good for me.
That would be great. Steve, where are you? There you are. Yeah, we had tried the old version of Rebel 1.2.1 on his nice tricked out OS 4, and it runs fine. So right now, that, but we would certainly like to see, you know, 1.3 and the rest of it as well, because you added a lot to it. I know not to try to put you on the spot or anything, but we just enjoy you coming and being here with us, and it's just a great thing for us. And we enjoy the rest of you being here too, because each of you has a story, and I really wish, and maybe we'll come up with something next year, you know, where everyone can come and talk into a microphone that's recording and say, you know, well, what do you do with the Amiga? What in the world are you here for anyway? You know, how long have you been with it? You know, I'm kind of ingrained myself. I've had one since 86 and used it the whole time. I've worked in offices that did Windows and big Unix systems and a couple of big IBM systems, and I hated them. That's part of my story. But it would be fun to hear everybody else's story too, how you came to the Amiga and that sort of thing. So maybe we'll try to set that up for next year. It would be pretty easy to do, really, especially on a little flash card reader, you know, flash card recorder. That would be great. So anyway, thanks for coming. It's been a great day, and I think if we Chuck and I have been talking, we'll probably do 2 days next year if we have this much interest. If you guys would be interested in 2 days, would that be a better deal? Because I know especially Jens and you guys coming from such great distance, it would be a lot better. Would it be better Friday, Saturday, or Saturday, Sunday? Saturday, Sunday? Okay. Saturday, Sunday? Okay. Okay. So, yeah, all of you here who are exhibitors this year will be contacting you. And as soon as we know what the exhibitor's end of it is for next year and trying to, just keep it going. Well, I don't know. We'll have to look into that as far as what they charge us here, because your ticket prices are basically charged on what we pay. So it might make it a little bit more expensive. Yeah, it might be $8 or $9 a day, something like that. But we'll have to look at that and see. We had that before too, because you had a Saturday pass, a Sunday pass, a whole weekend pass, whatever you want to do. And I think it makes it a little more flexible for you too, because if you can't come to both days, you can always plan to come to one. But it certainly gives us more time to schedule presenters and interviews and do better webcasts and things of that nature. So anyway, Alan. Do what now? Yes, that would be nice to have it and get some developers to actually get together and make this work. Yeah.
And I'll put in a plug for the Rebel Dev Con.
Go for it.
So there is a Dev Con coming up for Rebel, although it's in France. It's in Paris on May 10th and 11th. So anyone's interested, there you go. Now you have the information. You're ready to go, right?
Are you doing a webcast?
Oh, yeah, we always do that. Oh, yeah, cool. We always do a webcast, and there's a lot of people that are on the IRC channels or whatever.
Yeah. Well, we're moving to our club is moving to a new facility that has broadband in it, so we'll be able to access that kind of stuff now.
Okay.
Yeah, which would be really cool. That would be a lot of fun. So thanks for coming. See y'all next year. And please convey your appreciation to the vendors and exhibitors that were here by buying things from them. It always helps to motivate them to come back. Have a great year. Thanks for coming.
Hello. Let us see. Oh, stuff's still moving. Still doing stuff. I don't know if anyone's actually out there listening. I'm going to go ahead and shut things down. I hope you enjoyed everything today. I apologize that Bill couldn't make it. It would have been nice to hear from the man up top, apparently. It's my understanding he wanted to talk more about the OS5 initiative and so forth, but who knows? We got to worry about what we have today and not tomorrow. Maybe I'll contact Bill and set up a special webcast, because I hear he's in San Jose. I'm sure everyone would like to see some of that action. Anyway, have a great time, and I'll catch you guys next year from MUS 2007. This is Bill Techmage Borsari signing off. And special thanks to all my homies came in from Germany and across the country, across the world, to make this show fun and special. Good night.